Welcome to Money, Markets and Masterminds, a Citywire South Africa podcast that delves into the intricate world of finance, investment and strategic decision making. If you are an independent financial advisor, a fund selector or an institutional capitalist looking for insights, analysis or expert opinions, you're in the right place here with me, editor Ruan Uester. Today's episode is a retiring in Africa dialogue, and it's about us widening our lens. While most research on retirement and employee benefits in South Africa is pretty much locally centric and heavily quantitative, today's conversation is about qualitative lived experience from across the continent. We'll hear how retirement systems work on the ground in South Africa, Kenya, and Rwanda, from how benefits are communicated and understood to how cultural and economic contexts shape saving habits, and importantly, that the lessons that we learn from each other. My guests today are Mto Nkubi. He's a wealth manager and employee benefits consultant at GTC based in Johannesburg. Leroy Ontenu is an employee and retirement benefits consultant at the Zamara Group in Kenya. And Edmund Ade. He's a certified financial planner and founder of Premium Private Wealth with offices in both Rwanda and South Africa. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ruan.
Thank you so much, Ruan.
Thank you very much, Ruan.
This is a question to all of you. In most African countries, retirement and employee benefit systems face similar challenges: low participation, varying regulation, and limited awareness. But the solutions often look very different. So my question to all of you, what do you see as the biggest value in having this kind of cross-border conversation? And how can qualitative insights, actual lived experience, add to what we know from the data? Mto, let's start with you.
I suspect by trying to find out and communicating what other people are doing in other countries, because we're all in a single continent, there's certain things that work in other countries or other African countries that I definitely believe would apply, because the cultures are so ingrained, are the same, they are connected. So finding policies or solutions that apply in South Africa can definitely be fast-tracked by finding out what they're doing in other countries, Kenya and Rwanda. Retirement isn't so dissimilar in all these countries. The products aren't really so far apart that we can't find the niches and where we can find a balance to ultimately find a good or better solution for a local institution. You have other people in other countries, and they could find value in what we are doing in South Africa. So I think that cross-pollination could really push us towards good outcomes for retirement.
Leroy, and the news from Kenya.
Thank you, Ron. For me, the biggest problem that we have in Africa is pension coverage, right? That is, of course, the lag measure. That is what all of us intend to get to. The benefit in such engagements is to look at, for example, the data and look at how we can leverage off that data and lived experience to help each other collectively in Africa to increase that penetration, right? And also in our individual countries, right? In Kenya, for example, pension penetration is 20 to 25%. I'd love to hear what that is in Rwanda, what that is in SA, what is that in Egypt, for example, and are there similarities, right? If all of us are at 20 to 25%, are there similarities, and what can we do and leverage off each other to help ourselves both collectively and also in our individual countries?
Edmund, and your view from Rwanda?
Yeah, I think I will agree with Leroy and Paul there. It's about understanding the commonalities, you know, between those different systems across these countries, learning from what is working, what are the good points in some of these different systems, and how can those be adapted or even copied and integrated into our systems in other parts of the continent. What are the other things that are not working, and what, you know, what can be done about that? It's important to get those lessons. What are some of the solutions that are out there in the different countries, and are they portable? Is it transferable from one system to the other? What are some of the really common challenges, especially from a consumer perspective or from the individual perspective, and what's driving the different behavioral trends we are seeing. You know, what's, you know, impacting the fact that there's not a lot of participation in the schemes, and how can we encourage more participation? I think that's going to be central to the conversation, because at the end of the day, it's about making sure that people contribute as much as they need to. People understand the different benefits of why they need to save for retirement, and how they can maximize that. And so all of those different learnings we can take from different systems, and then ultimately design something that works for all in Africa.
While I have you on the line, Edmund, let's go over to a few country snapshots. Rwanda is often praised for its rapid policy reforms and development goals. How is that translated into the retirement and EB space? And how do you see employers viewing benefits as a compliance exercise or a genuine investment in staff welfare?
Yeah, that's a great one. I think I've been in Rwanda now 2 years, and although I don't necessarily advise on the local schemes, but of course when you are a financial advisor and you sit in a certain jurisdiction, you need to understand what's going on there. And my view is that Rwanda has been quite innovative, in the sense that they have two systems in place. They have the mandatory scheme, which is the national pension system, which is mandatory for everyone who is an employee. The employer contributes, the employee contributes, and that's managed by the National Pension Organization called the RSSB. And it gives them an old age pension. There's also a disability coverage there and a few other perks or benefits to it. So the coverage there is about 800,000 members currently in that scheme. These are for people that are employed. But one of the challenges we see across the board in Africa is the informal sector. There's a lot of, self-employed people in the informal sector. They don't have formal structures for saving for retirement. And I think that's where Rwanda has been quite innovative with their Ejehoza retirement savings scheme. It's a voluntary scheme where everyone can become a member, and you contribute as little as you can. There's no fixed amount to contribute. There's no obligation for how frequent you should contribute. And they're able to save up that in that scheme, again, managed by the RSSB. And that's a defined contribution scheme, which allows them to access it from age 55. And there are some incentives from the government to try and encourage people to participate in that scheme. The government will match their contributions subject to certain limits for the first 3 years. So that kind of encourages people to contribute to that scheme. And currently there are about 4 million members in that scheme. I think the biggest gap you're seeing in the market is around whether people understand if that saving, the amount they should be saving, you know, is there work to be done around really looking at how much individuals should be saving to make sure that they get the kind of retirement lifestyle that they want to lead. That's a gap that I see. But at least from a compliance perspective, the mandatory nature of the defined benefit scheme makes sure that, you know, everyone who's employed typically participates. And there's a lot of consumer education and consumer engagement going on to encourage a lot of participation in the voluntary scheme. And that has actually seen some growth in it. So that's what I see as positives in the innovation that Rwanda is putting in place from a policy perspective.
Leroy, in Kenya's market, how do employers and employees typically view retirement benefits? And how do you engage different segments from high-income professionals to blue-collar workers in conversations about their future social security?
Thank you, Ron. Thank you for that question. To give you some context, right, And I think from listening to Edmund, most of our systems seem to be pretty similar. To give you context of the Kenyan environment, so we do have what we call the National Social Security Fund, right? This could be a like-to-like for what Edmund has just described Ejehoza being. We do have occupational schemes, and we do have umbrella schemes. Occupational and umbrella schemes take care of those who are employed, right? We also have individual pension plans. Now, to just stick to the theme that Edmund has put forth, it is in the micropension space, the space in the informal sector, where in Africa we can make the biggest strides, right? From what I mentioned, Pension coverage in Kenya is 20 to 25%. Thereabout, we are hovering around 20 to 25% and we have been for quite a bit of time, right? Now, if you look at the statistics, we're about 50 million people in Kenya, right? Only 18 million are employed, right? So, of course, that sort of puts a glass ceiling into who you can reach. Of the 18 million, who have gainful employment, around 1 to 2 million are in formal employment. So they would be covered by both the NSSF, which is the Social Security Fund, and they would also be covered by the employer schemes. This leaves about 16 million people who are not covered, right? And to me and to us, it's been very clear for a very long time that if we want to change or we want to move the needle with regards to penetration, then we must get into that space. Another statistic to give you is that 80% of the jobs are in the informal sector in Kenya. And if for every 10 new jobs created, 8 are in the informal sector, right? So I believe putting a focus on the informal sector, because I believe the rest of the who are employed are sufficiently covered, right? But in the informal sector, our CEO Sandeep keeps on saying, we are almost sleepwalking into disaster, right? We are grappling with day to day, right? So a vegetable seller in Kenya is called a mama mboga, right? This mama mboga, that's Swahili, right? Is grappling with getting to tomorrow, right? The grappling with getting to tomorrow and not necessarily saving for their retirement. And retirement becomes a hard sell for them. But I think there are very many ways, and I think as we go with the conversation, we shall get into more detail. There are many ways within which Zamara has done this or has visioned this through partnerships with Pinbox, for example, who are also responsible for Ejoheza in Rwanda. So to me, the focus away from all these high net worth individuals, which we are sort of we have dealt with, the focus for us then is in this informal sector. And moving forward, we shall get into more details on that one.
Mto, give us a quick overview of the South African EBN retirement landscape as you see it, especially from your position of both advising clients and sitting on retirement fund boards. What are our current strengths and where are the gaps?
Thank you, Ruan. I'd say we're very broad in how we attack clients, majority of which sits with employer funds, so your occupational retirement funds facilitated by the private sector. So majority of the capital that you have in the country is sitting with your private sector, but you also have your standalone funds like the GEPF, which are your public sector funds. So most, if not all individuals really participate in those. The private sector then comes in and supplements for those who want to contribute for themselves directly using just your direct retirement funds, more retirement annuities rather, in the private sector again. So generally speaking, you have the private sector driving member participation in retirement funds. The one point that we miss is naturally, as you can see, is informal sector impact. And also there is no mandatory or compulsory retirement fund for all individuals, right? You have to either take one up for yourself or be a part of an institution that then helps you facilitate one. They did try and lodge, actually there was a green paper written about it in 2021, but you had backlash or feedback from those who contribute to say that it wasn't ready, it wasn't going to be as impactful and should really be rethought. But generally speaking, majority of the people participate in private sector retirement funds.
This is a question for all of you, you again, but Nto, let's start with you. Looking at the three countries that we are discussing today, what are the most striking differences in legislation, product design, or cultural attitudes towards retirement? And which of those differences could be turned into learning opportunities for others? Mto?
Definitely the micro pension system that exists in Rwanda and Kenya. So it is that which allows any individual to contribute and save for retirement, even the smallest of friends. I believe if we convert the equivalent of what the Rwandan system allows, it's as small as 20 Rand. So for 20 Rand, you're allowed to then access a retirement fund. And you then, I mean, contributing to a retirement fund isn't just about you knowing that you'll have capital in the future. It also means that you're taking advantage of those tax incentives. In the short term, you're actually lowering your income tax that you're paying, right? So I would suspect that for the South African market, that's the one that we would admire the most and most likely look to implement the most, micro pensions. It also goes hand in hand with how they are using mobile technology. So everybody has a cell phone. Everybody, even people who you would think shouldn't have that kind of internet access, if anything, have access to a mobile phone. So why don't we find a way to connect with them and bring them closer into participating into retirement funds? So if I was to say one item which I suspect is the most appealing, it is micro pensions.
Leroy, any lessons to be learned from Rwanda or South Africa from a Kenyan perspective?
There are very many, Ron. There are very many lessons to be learned. Yeah? And if I just follow through with what Edmond had said earlier, and it seems that the theme in this engagement is micro pensions, right? The biggest and most striking difference between the micro pensions system environment in Kenya and in Rwanda, for example, is for Ejoheza, it is mandatory, right? It is mandatory, and then the government comes in to subsidize. In Kenya, what we are grappling with is we are looking at, for example, Zamara, right, who were the first to come up with a solution. We are grappling with the private sector coming in to push sort of public initiatives, as it were, or social security initiatives, right? And in the public sector, I mean, in the private sector, of course, I report to the head of retail solutions. He then reports to Sandeep, and Sandeep then reports to the board, right? The cost of going into the markets or going into this cohort is massive, right? It's very capital intensive. So, and the typically, if it's not mandatory or if it's not backed by the government or backed by institutions such as the World Bank, then the application time or the time within which you would want to see it gets to completion is a bit long. So it gets a bit difficult for boards to then willy-nilly give you money, right, at the upfront to go and set up some of the structures that are needed. Partnership, in terms of product design, as Mtho had mentioned, in Kenya, for example, we have M-Pesa, right? And M-Pesa has the potential or is the main differentiator, I would say, with regards to us fighting to expand micro pensions, in that anyone who has a phone, be it a smartphone or be it the mamamboga I spoke about, without a smartphone can transact, and they can send money and they can save money, and if you don't have internet, they can sort of use USSD and the like. So the striking difference for me between Rwanda and Kenya in that micro pension space would be accessibility, and would be sort of public versus private sector pushing the micro pensions agenda. With regards to ASA, from the different engagements I've had personally, I get the sense that the taxation environment in ASA is easier and sort of brings to the fore a lot of benefits in the way of exemptions. Our tax regime seems to be a bit more complex, but we are making strides. Year after year, we keep on improving. Given that this is legislation, then you must then involve, you must lobby, you must involve the parliamentarians, you must, the RBA then, which is the Retirement Benefits Authority, is constantly lobbying to ensure that we have a good or a tax system that incentivizes people to save for their retirement rather than spend it now.
Gentlemen, and this is for all of you again, given that a large proportion of Africa's workforce is informal, as you all mentioned before, how do you convince someone outside the formal economy to start saving for retirement? Have you seen examples where outreach really changed people's behavior? Mtho, let's start with you.
The first question is slightly difficult, but about outreach, I would say if we refer to the two-part system here, we know that mass engagement with members really does help with outcomes. So you'll find, for example, at GTC or even other institutions, when the two-part system came into play, you had a requirement for institutions to speak to and counsel members about the impact of doing a withdrawal from a fund. So you could even generally get to the point of getting them to find other alternative solutions as opposed to withdrawing from their retirement fund. So there's always merit to communicating with members and giving them the full spectrum of what a decision actually means. So in the same way, I believe if we were educating and communicating the fact that retirement is coming and it is best to start as early as possible with as little as you can over time, while doing that, give the benefits of the actual retirement fund. So to say that it's not just only your own savings, it's the fact that you're protected from creditors. If you go into debt, they can't come and take it. If you pass away, it is going to go to your financial dependents. So those specific benefits, or getting into the specific detail about the benefits of a retirement fund, could definitely influence people to save towards retirement. Naturally, there is the socioeconomic reasons why people do not save for retirement, and we can't duck and dive around those. I need to pay for school fees before I need to eat before I save for retirement. Those will always be there, but as long as the systems are in place to ensure that the people are well aware of the benefits of retirement funds, when they have the ability, they can start taking advantage of them because they are already aware of them. We shouldn't shy away from trying to educate and get them to save for retirement because of the socioeconomic issues, which exist everywhere. So for me, I definitely think because of where we're coming from legislation-wise and requiring member engagement, there is benefit in educating and talking to members about retirement.
Well, let's go over to Leroy. What is the experience with dealing with the informal sector in Kenya?
Our experience is vast and varied, but allow me to speak to the Zamara approach and how we went through thinking through the informal sector. And this is based off of a lot of research. We engage a lot of people to research on our behalf, and also the Retirement Benefits Authority came in handy with also shaping our thinking. Now, in Kenya, as Mto has rightly put it, and across Africa, there is the problem of poverty. There's poverty now, right? And we are trying to address poverty in the future, which is old age poverty. So naturally, there would be conflicting interests, right? Am I going to eat today, or am I going to think about tomorrow that I'm not very sure I'm going to be here in 20 to 30 years? So it becomes a hard sell. It's a hard sell enough in the formal sector, so you can imagine how much more difficult, or what factor of difficulty you bring in when it's in the informal sector. But it's not all doom and gloom, right? What we figured out is technology is important, right? Engagement with people in the informal sector requires us to not have papers or paperwork, for example. So in designing our scheme, which is called the Fahari Retirement Plan, we designed a scheme that is completely paperless from start to finish, from onboarding to claims to even engagement. Everything is sort of paperless. Now, if you come to the product design, there are three things within the Kenyan market that are needed. One, there is, of course, your financial benefit, hence pensions, hence the savings element of pensions. There is also protection that is very important to us, especially, for example, last expense insurance, right? Currently, if I look at my phone, every week, if someone passes away, the way we deal with it in Kenya is that we form a WhatsApp group, we get people in, we form what we call a chama. A chama is just a group that comes together to sort out something financial, and we sort of send that out to the bereaved, right? So last expense benefit is a bit more important for us, in that you pay a premium, and it's a low premium. It's 100 shillings per year, which is about 20 cents. So very affordable. We were fortunate enough to get partners in the way of underwriters who gave us that benefit. The other huge thing in Kenya right now is yen or loans or And these are mostly mobile loans, right? So with the advent of financial literacy, the more you increase the ability for people to get access to finances or to information, you also increase the risk that they will not make the best decisions, right? So we have, you have mobile loans, you have loan sharks, you have a lot of people who are, I don't want to use the word exploiting, but are not necessarily treating the people in the informal sector that fairly. So we thought that with the micro pension and a way to incentivize is one, bundle it with protection, right? And also bundle it with a way within which they can borrow off their savings or borrow off their good behavior at reasonable interest rates for the informal sector. Just to give an example, Safaricom, which is the biggest mobile operator or MNO in Kenya, has a credit age or overdraft facility called Fuliza, right? Within the first couple of days, I think, I'm trying to remember the statistic, or month, they had lent 6 billion Kenya shillings, right? And that tells you, and you know to who they are lending this to. It's to people in the informal sector who are borrowing and then paying and then getting themselves, as I said, sleepwalking into disaster in a way that you get into a cycle of poverty, right? Where you're paying, you're being subjected to high interest rates, right? And then you have to keep on paying back. So it's endless. It becomes sort of a very bad cycle. So we thought that would help. So tech, bundling of the solutions to sort of curtail or to look at all the problems that sector is sort of facing. And also, we also figured out that the informal sector is not coalesced. There are very many small segments within the informal sector. For example, you could see farmers are in the informal sector. You can have a milk farmer in Kenya, in the highlands of Kenya, in a place like Kiambu. That person could be earning millions of shillings. But you can have a farmer or a small farmer, subsistence farmer with a bit of commercial to it, earning peanuts, right? So sort of segmenting correctly and figuring out who are these people, who are these layers within the informal sector was very key. Also in our marketing, we sort of figured out that you would want to market to different people, to what speaks to them, right? If you have manufacturing, for example, you can have a manufacturer's plan with incentives to help them to save, a farmer's plan, etc. So, and from what I'm saying, you can see now that how the expenses start rolling in and it becomes sort of a hard sell in the private sector. However, we continue to push forward and we continue to ensure that we are engaging. Financial literacy is huge, right? So we are finding that even as you try to give solutions, the overarching theme is that financial literacy is the major problem. People do not see why they need to save. So you first sort of need to go through financial literacy to educate people on why they need to save for their retirement, why having a nest egg in retirement is important, and then sort of saying that this is our solution. So that has sort of been our experience in trying to crack that sector.
Edmund, how do people in Rwanda convince the informal sector to enter the formal pension fund structures available? And do you have any example where outreach has actually changed people's behavior?
Yes, Ron, I think the Johannesburg scheme actually has people that go out for community outreaches through different organizations, well-structured organizations. Sometimes they go to schools, they go to universities, they go to different informal sector groupings to just try and educate them on why they should be saving for retirement. And I think the scheme where the government actually matches contributions, at least for the first 3 years, it's a big incentive, which gets people to just get their foot through the door and at least get to contribute. Whether they are contributing enough, you know, is a secondary question. At least, you know, just get started. And as you get, you know, part of this whole thing is a discipline story as well. So when you just get started, at some point you become a bit more disciplined and you start to see some of the benefits, then it becomes a lot easier for people to keep up. And the fact that it's quite flexible in terms of your frequency of contribution, you know, you don't have to be, you don't have to feel obligated and committed to, you know, to stick to a contribution pattern. You can contribute as little as you can. You can stop when you don't have, and you can continue again. All of those, I think, are good incentives for why people are taking up the contribution into the scheme. I think overall, the financial literacy conversation that Lira was talking about, I believe everyone knows that that's really where it needs to be improved. It's not just a question of talking to people, but it's more around what exactly are we telling them? What exactly is the messaging that we're telling them? You know, we have to be giving, the statistics are there, they're damning, but it doesn't still change some of the reality. So the kind of financial literacy education or the quality of the education also becomes really critical. I think those are areas where there need to be serious improvement. Access to, in my view, access to financial advisors should be similar to access to doctors. I think that if we can create a system where you know, if we have created a system where it's kind of mandatory for people to contribute when they are employed, then probably we should be thinking about some system where they have access to some kind of mandatory advice, or at least access to really well-structured and formalized financial advisors who can guide them properly on not just why they should be saving, but how they should be doing it and how they should improve. And then, thankfully, they don't have all the complications like in South Africa in terms of the choices. Where you're saying, okay, am I doing a, you know, pension? Is it a provident fund? Is it a retirement annuity? You know, am I transferring from one to the other? All of those different dynamics, they don't really have to deal with that. That's a good thing. So it's very simple. You're either employed and you are in the compulsory scheme, which actually has a voluntary scheme as well. And then you have the informal sector scheme for microinsurance. And ultimately, the conversation should move from more people should be contributing, and later on it should be, are we contributing enough? I think that's actually the next dimension to the contribution as well, to the conversation.
Edmund, we just looked at Kenya and South Africa and what the most striking differences in legislation, product design, or cultural attitudes towards retirement is. What is the view of all of these things in Rwanda?
I think. The big one for me, if I were to compare it with South Africa, is the incentive to contribute, which is, in my view, underpinned by the fact that contributions are tax deductible. I think that the tax deductibility of contributions into retirement savings is a big factor why South Africa is actually far ahead of everyone else in the continent around contribution into formal savings plans. The fact that we don't have that in Rwanda, I think at the moment, for me, it's a big deficiency in the system, and it needs to be looked at. Currently, contributions made by the employer is tax deductible for the employer, but it's not tax deductible for the employee. So I believe that there is a gap there. If we create that incentive to say, if I make contributions, then I benefit with the tax deductions, I think that's a huge incentive that would encourage a lot more contributions into formal retirement savings. Because a lot of people are now thinking, well, we have alternative assets that we can look at for retirement. So this conversation, we are limiting it to formal contributions to retirement plans. But people are saying, listen, I have my residential property, which is going to give me rental income. And so that's an alternative income source. I don't necessarily have to do a formal retirement plan. However, if there is that kind of incentive, which is sustainable and long-term, I believe a lot more people would, you know, rather than choose to contribute into formal retirement savings.
As a last question, which is also aimed at all three of you, if you could make one reform or innovation in your country's EB or retirement system tomorrow, what would it be and why? Mto, let's start with closer to home.
I am fee sensitive, so I would most likely look towards reconsidering or reconvening and talking about how institutions specifically whether you're talking about advisors, asset managers, administrators, everybody involved in the food chain gets remunerated. Financial advice is linked directly to getting the most the biggest clients through the door. So generally speaking, you find that advisors are trying to find their volumes, find their biggest client. There is no discounts for the smaller clients. Generally speaking, you find that a fee, if it's 1%, it's 1% for everybody. Where possibly we should consider maybe there should be lesser tiered fees for smaller clients because they're still accumulating. Maybe we should consider certain maximums that differentiate between smaller clients and larger clients. You deal with higher net worth clients who can generally pay for specific type of advice. They can pay for a tax consultant, they can pay for a lawyer, they can pay for an advisor, they can pay for a conveyancer, all of those things, they're accessible to them because that's available as a costing. But lower down the tiers where mistakes for tax or mistakes for incorrect advice can be absolutely life-changing and detrimental to an individual. And because the remuneration or how people live is linked to the to how many clients they're signing, you might have some bad habits creeping in. So over time, there has been a lot of changes that have come in that have streamlined fees and but more so streamlining disclosure. Have you told the client the correct information? Have you sold the right product? Right. But there isn't a lot that's happening in terms of remuneration. If we actually cross the board and we go and talk about medical aid is different in terms of how they bill their clients. They also give advice, but there's a way smaller premium or fee that they receive as a medical aid consultant. Whereas on the advice side and the financial planning side, it's different. So for me, I would look at that. On the asset management side, South Africa is lucky because we have a big economy and the asset managers have a fairly big pool of companies to look to invest into. That's even ignoring the fact that they can also go offshore. So they have a big playground to put your money and invest your money. But are the fees fair? Right. Are we talking about, I always ask why we've never talked about an underperformance fee. We talk about a performance fee, but what about an underperformance fee? There are places like Ireland which do have those types of items. So for me, I would most likely zone into fee structures and just making sure that they are best for end user clients who are saving for a significantly long time. We're moving into, we are in the two-pot system where people are putting in money. You're going to be 20, you have money going into your retirement pot. It's going to be in there until you turn 55. Absolutely no doubt. There's nothing you can do about it. So is the fee fair that's happening in there? If we know that it's going, I'm going to have my money in here for 35, 40, 45 years. So that for me would most likely be the most important one to attack. Second, a close second would be micropensions in South Africa.
Edmund, does Rwanda's retirement system need a renaissance and way?
Yeah, just like any system, there's always a need for improvement, right? There's not a perfect pension system out there. I think there's always room for improvement. In my view, three areas would probably need some, you know, quick tweaking or changes initially. And there's a whole lot of other areas that it needs work and improvement. It's relatively nascent system in my view, and there's a lot of work to be done. But the first area, of course, on the policy side would be, I think I alluded to that initially, would be probably considering the tax deductibility of contributions for employees as a quick fix, a quick win, because I believe, you know, most people don't like to pay tax, or at least not pay as much tax. And so anything that gives a, you know, the impression that you're reducing your taxes would probably be a quick win. I think the fact that the government is, is matching contributions for the first 3 years suggests that the government is willing to incentivize contributions into the scheme. And so that incentive can come in one way or the other. Do you collect the taxes and then put it back in there, or do you just give people an incentive to say, if you contribute, you get the tax deduction? I believe psychologically, it's probably a quick fix to suggest that there should be the deductibility instead of you matching the contributions. That's in my view. On the scheme side themselves, in terms of, I think there's big challenges around the investment management. I think when Paul is talking about costs, you know, that's a much, I would say that's a better problem, if you ask me, in South Africa. Here we have structural issues around where to actually invest the money. We're talking about financial markets that are not as deep as you would like. So the options of where to invest are kind of limited. So the whole investment management itself, in terms of finding opportunities to grow pension assets, is an area that would also need looking at. Probably considering a bit more offshore exposure. I mean, I saw recently in South Africa that they have actually increased that threshold to about 45%. I think that could be another area where we could look at to say, how do we take advantage of other markets where we can actually pursue some growth opportunities to make sure that the pension assets are growing as they should be. I think that's critical, especially when you're running a defined benefit scheme like the compulsory one we have. It's a defined benefit scheme, which means that those assets need to be growing as much as possible to keep paying for those liabilities as they go. But I think the third one has to be on the consumer literacy side or the financial literacy side, what exactly can be done. I think, you know, we probably could copy a bit from the UK. They have the Pension Advice Service, which is like a free service that anyone can access and get some advice on different aspects of their pension. I think that's something that can be put in place. Find the right qualified individuals, whether it's a call center structure or whatever it is, but you know, with some free direct line and access to anyone can call in and have direct advice to a certain limit, of course, on their pension. I think that those could be three areas that I would quickly want to put in.
Leroy, as the last voice on this vodcast, what do you want to see happen in Kenya?
Just to bring us back to where we began, right? We began, I think, Ron, your question, the question that you asked me was how engagements like this are beneficial. Right, and if you look at the theme of what all of us are talking about, it's a bit similar. It's some small differences, but it's similar, right? You need incentivization to get into the pension schemes and tax, right? You need accessibility and the like. So in Kenya, allow me to just split pensions or retirement into two. You have formal and you have the informal sector. Now, in the formal sector, those schemes have been around since the 80s, right? So small strides continue to be made. But at the front of anyone who's lobbying for a better retirement landscape in this country, the first thing, and also Edmond and also Joe have sort of brought this to the fore, is incentivization and tax. Right, so in the formal sector, we could always benefit from having higher tax exemption. In Kenya, for example, I think it's a year since that was increased. It has always been, well, at least since I came into the industry, 20,000 Kenya shillings as a tax deductible. It has now moved to 30,000, and of course, we could always benefit with it being higher. So I would not want anyone in our Kenya Revenue Authority to kill me for saying this, right? but we could always benefit from having those tax deductibles. If you come into the informal sector, again, number one would be tax incentives, right? We need to incentivize our mama mboga or our motorcycle rider, who are a big part of our economy, to save for their retirement, right? We need to sort of help them. So there are very many points I can put forth there, but the best thing for us, in my opinion, is that we must then have a formalized micro pensions and formalized micro pensions legislation, which brings all this together. You can have the tax incentives, right? And to me, I don't see why a micro pension scheme, right, which currently don't have. Remember, what we are doing is, of course, innovation comes before legislation, right? So what we're trying to do is to fit in micro pensions into our individual pension plan regulations, right? Well, that is sort of working out in that regard, right? There are still gaps that need to be sorted out, right? If we want the informal sector to save, they do not want to hear anything to do with taxation, for example, right? It's designing those micropension scheme to ensure that, yes, you can get taxation from these micropension schemes, but put that burden on the scheme, right? And you can get a lot of taxation, or you can get good taxation, whatever is right in taxation, through the income, right? So whatever income the scheme makes, you can tax that, right? And make sort of carry, can sort of make their revenues. So tax, right? We need to incentivize people to save, and especially people in that sector. That being said, I think we are on the right path, right? And engagements like this, to me, are very beneficial. And we can see sort of where it bites us in Kenya. I think it's biting in Rwanda. It's the same in South Africa in some different ways. But it's good to take the lessons. For example, Ejoheza and what we are doing is not different. It's just that Ejoheza is public sector driven by the government. And for us, we're trying to do it in the private sector. 800,000 to 1 million lives there. And for us, we are just sort of getting to the thousands mark and then into the millions mark. So legislation, to me, in Africa, as is most of our problems, must then conform to allow us to then reach to the masses.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. And thank you, Mntu, Leroy and Edmund, for joining us and helping us to unpack the challenges and opportunities in retirement planning across our continent. This conversation shows how valuable it is to share experiences beyond our borders, because while the contexts differ, the goals are the same: better outcomes and dignity in retirement for workers across Africa. To all our Citywide South African listeners, thank you for tuning into this special Retiring in Africa Roundtable with me, editor Ruan Uester, and my producer, Alan Walsh, from the Citywire Studios team. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your network. We are available on all major platforms such as Spotify and Apple Podcasts and Iona.fm. All Citywire South Africa podcasts and videos are also available on our website. So please go register and have a look at our wealth of multimedia content. And with that, and until next time, goodbye.